namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
So we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 12, Chapter 8, Text 1. Sri Sunaku Vacha Sutta Jiva Chidam Sadho Vadano Vadatam Vada Tamashyapali Brahmatam Nirinam Tvam Padam Darshana Sri Sunaku Vacha. Sri Sunaka said, Sutta, O Sutta Goswami, Jiva, may you live, Chiram, for a long time, Sado, O Saint, Vada, please speak, Naha, to us, Vadatam, of speakers. Vada, O you who are the best. Tamasi, in darkness. Apare, unbounded. Brahmatam, who are wandering. Rinam, for men. Tvam, you. Paradarshana, the seer of the opposite shore. Translation, Sri Sunaka said, O Sutta, may you live a long life. O saintly one, the best of speakers, please continue speaking to us. Indeed, you can show men the path out of ignorance in which they are wandering. Translation responsively, Sri Sunaka said, O Sutta, may you live a long life. O saintly one, best of speakers,
please continue speaking to us.
Indeed, only you
can show men the path
out of ignorance in which they are wandering. Purport by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. According to Srila Jiva Goswami, the sages saw that Sutta Goswami was about to end his narration of the Srimad Bhagavatam, and thus they urged him to tell the story of Markandeya Rishi. So this is a really interesting. You know how when we have a kirtan and the kirtan is really ecstatic, and the devotees go, Hari Bol, Hari Bol, Hari Bol, Hari Bol, wanting to keep on going? So this is what the sages were doing. This is what Sunakrishna and all the sages are doing. Saying, no, we don't want this to stop. We want this to be good. Let's keep it going. Hurry, boo! Hurry, boo! And so they thought, okay, let's think of another story. Okay, Markandeya Rishi. Tell us about Markandeya Rishi. So then Sutta Goswami starts explaining. So what I want to do is just keep reading some of the verses. There's not many purports. So just to get the story of Markandeya Rishi, and then we'll do the purport after that. I'll just read the English translation. Authority said that Markandeya Rishi, the son of Makunda, Mrikandu, was an exceptionally long-lived sage who was the only survivor at the end of the day of Brahman, when the entire universe was merged into the flood of annihilation. But this same Markandeya Rishi, the foremost descendant of Bhrigu, took birth in my own family during the current day of Rama, and we have not yet seen any total annihilation in this day of Brahman. Also, it is well known that Markandeya, while wandering helplessly in the great ocean of annihilation, saw in those fearful waters a wonderful personality, an infant boy lying alone within the fold of a banyan leaf. O Sutta, I am most bewildered and curious about this great sage, Markandeya Rishi. O great You are universally accepted as the authority on the Puranas. Therefore, kindly dispel my confusion. It's a brief report here. Lord Brahma's day, consisting of his 12 hours, lasts 4,320,000,000 years. And his night is of the same duration. Apparently, Markandeya lived through one such day and night, and in the following day of Brahma continued living as the same Markandeya. It seems that when annihilation occurs during Brahma's night, the sage wandered throughout the fearful waters of destruction and saw within these waters the extraordinary personality lying on a bunion leaf. All of these mysteries concerning Mukundeya will be clarified by Siddha Goswami at the request of the great sages. Translation: Siddha Goswami said, O great sage Sunak, your very question will help remove everyone's illusion, for it leads to the topics of Narayan, which cleanses away the contaminations of this Kali Yuga. After being purified by his father's performance of the prescribed rituals leading to Mukundeya's Brahminical initiation, Mukundeya studied the Vedic hymns and strictly observed the regulative principles. He became advanced in austerity and Vedic knowledge and remained a lifelong celibate, appearing most peaceful. With his matted hair and his clothing made of bark, he furthered his spiritual progress by carrying the mendicants water pot, staff, sacred thread, brahmachari belt, black deerskin, lotus seed prayer beads, and a bundle of kusa grass. At the sacred juncture of the day, he regularly worshipped the Supreme Personality of Godhead in fine forms: the sacrificial fire, the sun, his spiritual master, and the brahmanas and the super soul within his heart. Morning and evening he would go out begging, and upon returning he would present all the foods that he had collected to his spiritual master. Only when his spiritual master invited him would he silently take his meal for that day. Otherwise he would fast. Thus devoted to austerity and Vedic study, Mukundeya Rishi worshipped the Supreme Master of the Senses, the Personality of Godhead, for countless millions of years, and in this way he conquered unconquerable death. Lord Brahma, Bhrigu, Muni, Lord Shiva, Prajapati Daksha, the great sons of Brahma, and many others among the human beings, demigods, forefathers and ghostly spirits were all astonished to see the achievements of Mukundeya Rishi. In this way, the devotional mystic Mukundeya maintained rigid celibacy through penance, study of the Vedas and self-discipline. With his mind thus free from all disturbances, he turned inward and meditated on the Supreme Personality of Godhead who lies beyond the material senses. O Brahmana, during the seventh reign of Manu, the current age, Lord Indra came to know of Mukundeya's austerities and became fearful of his growing mystic potency, and thus he tried to impede the sage's penances. So here we come, Indra comes into the scene again. Whoops, there's somebody that's that could be a threat to me, so I'll have to do something about this guy. To ruin the sage's spiritual practice, Lord Indra sent Cupid, beautiful celestial singers, dancing girls, seasons of spring, and the sandalwood scented breeze from the Malayan hills, along with greed and intoxication personified. So this was his army that he sent to poor old Mukundeya, right? He's got Cupid, who is the god of lust, beautiful celestial singers, dancing girls, season of spring, most beautiful season, and sandalwood scented breeze from the Malayan hills, along with the personification of greed and intoxication. O most powerful Sanat, they went to Mukundeya's hermitage on the northern side of the Himalayan mountains, where the Pushpa-Bhadra river passes by the famous peak Chitra. Groves of pious trees decorated the holy ashram of Mukundeya Rishi, and many saintly brahmanas lived there, enjoying the abundant, pure, sacred pond. The ashram resounded with the buzzing of intoxicated bees and the cooing of excited cuckoos, with jubilant peacocks dancing about. Indeed, many families of maddened birds crowded the hermitage. The springtime breeze sent by Lord Indra entered there, carrying cooling drops of spray from nearby waterfalls, fragrance from the embrace of forest flowers. That breeze entered the hermitage and began to invoke the lusty spirit of Cupid. So you can see the scene. It was like a hermitage, and then this beautiful sort of scene started to manifest. Springtime then appeared in Mukundeya's ashram. Indeed, the evening sky, glowing with the light of the rising moon, became the very face of spring, and sprouts and fresh blossoms virtually covered the multitude of trees and creepers. Cupid, the master of many heavenly women, then came there, holding his bow and arrows. He was followed by a group of Gandharvas playing musical instruments and singing. The servants of Indra found the sage sitting in meditation, having just offered his prescribed oblations into the sacrificial fire, his eyes closed in trance. He seemed invincible, like fire personified. The women danced before the sage, and the celestial singers sang to the charming accompaniment of drums, cymbals, and veenas. While the son of passion, greed personified, Spring, and the other servants of Indra all tried to agitate Markandeya's mind, Cupid drew his five-headed arrow and fixed it upon his bow. So this is his secret weapon. The apsara, Punjita Kastahali, made a show of playing with a number of toy balls. Her waist seemed weighted down by her heavy breasts, and the wreath of flowers in her hair became disheveled. As she ran about after the ball, glancing here and there, the belt of her thin garment loosened, and suddenly the wind blew her clothes away. Cupid, thinking he had conquered the sage, then shot his arrow. But all these attempts to seduce Markandeya proved futile, just like the useless endeavors of an atheist. Aluna Sanak, while Cupid and his followers tried to harm the sage, they felt themselves being burnt alive by his potency. They just stopped their mischief, just like little children who have aroused the sleeping snake. O Brahmana, the followers of Lord Indra had impudently attacked the great sage Markandeya, yet he did not succumb to any of the influence of false ego. For the great soul, such tolerance is not at all surprising. The mighty King Indra was most astonished when he heard of the mystic prowess of the exalted sage Markandeya, and so it saw how Cupid and his associate had become powerless in his presence. Desiring to bestow his mercy upon the saintly Markandeya, who had perfectly fixed his mind in self-realization through penance, Vedic studies, and the observances of regulative principles, the Supreme Personality of Godhead personally appeared before the sage in the form of Naranarayana. One of them of a whitish complexion, the other blackish, and they both had four arms. Their eyes resembled the petals of blooming lotuses, and they wore garments of black deerskin and bark, and along with the three strands they could thread. In their hands, which were most yes, excuse me, I've got a cold while I was in too. In their hands, which were most purifying, they carried the mendicant's pot, straight bamboo staff, and lotus seed prayer beads, as well as the all-purifying Vedas in the symbolic form of bundles of pusaka. Might need a few of these. Still got some left. Their bearing was tall, and their yellow effulgences the colour of radiant lightning, appearing as auspiciousness personified, austerity personified. They were being worshipped by the foremost demigods. The two sages, Nara and Narayan, were direct personal forms of the Lord. When Markandeya Rishi saw them, he immediately stood up and then with great respect offered them obeisances by falling down flat on the ground like a stick. The ecstasy of seeing them completely satisfied Markandeya's body and mind and senses and caused the hairs on his body to stand on end and his eyes to fill with tears. Overwhelmed, Markandeya found it difficult to look at them. Standing with his hands folded in subjugation and his head bowed in humility, Markandeya felt such eagerness that he imagined he was embracing the Lord, embracing the two lords. in a voice choking with ecstasy. This is not choking with ecstasy. He repeatedly said, "I offer you my humble obeisances." He gave them sitting places and washed their feet, and when he worshipped them with presentations of agra and sandalwood pulp, fragrant oils, incense and flower garments, Markandeya once again bowed down at the lotus feet of the two most worshipable sages, who were sitting at ease, ready to bestow all mercy upon him. He then addressed them as follows. Sri Markandeya said, "O Almighty Lord, how can I possibly describe you? You awaken the vital air, which then dispels the mind, senses, and power of speech to act. This is true for all ordinary conditioned souls, and even for great demigods like Brahma and Shiva. So it is certainly true for me. Nevertheless, you become the intimate friend of those who worship you. O Supreme Personality of Godhead, these two personal forms of yours have appeared to bestow the ultimate benefit for the three worlds, the cessation of the material misery and the conquest of death. My Lord, although you created this universe and then assumed many transcendental forms to protect it, you always swallow it up just like a spider who spins and later withdraws its web. Because you are the protector and the supreme controller of all moving and non-moving beings, anyone who takes shelter of your lotus feet can never be touched by the contaminations of material work."
Thank you.
"Material qualities of time. Great sages who have assimilated the essential meaning of the Vedas offer their prayers to you. To gain your association, they bow down to you at every opportunity and constantly worship and meditate upon you. My dear Lord, even Lord Brahma, who enjoys his exalted position for the entire duration of the universe, fears the passage of time. Then what to speak of those whom Brahma creates, the conditioned souls? They encounter fearful dangers at every step of their lives. I do not know of any relief from this fear except the shelter of your lotus feet, which are the very form of liberation. Therefore I worship your lotus feet. Having renounced my identification with the material body and everything else that covers my true self, these useless, insubstantial and temporary coverings are merely presumed to be separate from you, whose intelligence, compassion encompasses all truth. By attaining you, the Supreme Godhead and the Master of the Soul, one attains everything desirable." Purport. "One who falsely identifies himself as the material body or the mind automatically feels entitled to exploit the material world. But when we realize our eternal spiritual nature and Lord Krishna's supreme proprietorship over all that be, we renounce our false enjoyment propensity by the strength of spiritual knowledge. Om Ajnana Timiran Dasya Gananjana Shalakya Chakshula Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurudev Namaha Nama Om Vishnu Badaya Krishna Vastaya Bhutale Shrimati Hridayananda Goswami Niti Namine Nama Om Vishnu Badaya Krishna Vastaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namine Namaste Saraswati Devam Gauravani Pacharine Nevashesha Shunivari Pashachari Satarine Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasati Gaura Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So this is the story. I just thought I would read that passage. The wonderful example of Markandeya Rishi and how he overcome the onslaughts of material contamination. Markandeya Rishi ultimately had the great opportunity of seeing the Supreme Personality of Godhead due to his austerity, because of his performance of Krishna consciousness. Naranarayan Rishi is one of the incarnations of Vishnu. One of the incarnations of Vishnu. The twin brothers, Nara and Narayan. There is a temple in Badranath, which is one of the most famous temples for Naranarayan Rishi. And the Lord is said to still reside within that area of Badranath. So here again, we hear from the Shastras how God is a person. He actually personally appeared. Now you had this great sage, Markandeya Rishi, who had all spiritual power. I mean, he practiced for so long, the whole day and night, Lord Brahma, He actually was an amazing sage. And instead of finally coming to a personal conclusion, he maintained his devotion to Krishna. And in the end, Krishna came to him as Narayana Rishi, and then he was overwhelmed by love and affection for the Supreme Lord. So this is true ecstasy, not merging into a negative, impersonal Brahmajyoti, just a light, but to actually have that personal connection, love with Krishna. So Krishna and this personal concept of the Lord is not realized in very many religions. Actually, it's when you do interfaith work, you're actually surprised at how impersonal even a lot of the traditional religions that claim to be monotheistic are. They actually haven't got a complete, real, personal understanding of the Supreme Person of Godhead. And thereby, they find it very difficult to love the Supreme Person of Godhead. Krishna is the person. Ishvara Paramakrishna, such a thing. Brahma Samhita explains, Lord Brahma points out how Krishna is the person. So this is described that one who struggles against Maya for self-realization, like Markandeya, is a hero. I don't know if anybody saw in the latest DVD, but there's a really nice article there on who are real heroes. You know, in the Western world we have so many heroes. But really, the heroes are these people that are presented, these great sages, these great personalities that are presented in the Bhagavatam, and how they overcome the allurements of Maya to stay fixed in the service of Krishna. So Markandeya Rishi was a very sober, and very steady personality in Krishna consciousness. And although this is an example of a great sage who maintained his determination in serving Krishna for a long period of time, sometimes we may read this pastime and think, oh God, how long do I have to perform this devotional service? How many, millions and millions of years of the day of Lord Brahman, the night of Lord Brahman, this diligent thing. And when we're in this condition state, when we're just coming to Krishna consciousness, we can sometimes feel, boy, is there going to be an end? The beauty of spiritual life is, the point that's mentioned, is that this sobriety and this determination is actually very fulfilling. Because it's that sobriety and that determination, that dhira, that brings about freedom. And the thing that human society strives for, every living entity strives for, is freedom, emancipation, liberation, moksha. And to have this dhira takes someone quite advanced to keep on going. So Markandeya Rishi has, as was mentioned here, total control of his senses. He was in total control of his senses. He could not be enticed by Cupid's five-pronged arrow at all. He was free from sex desire. And this is a very major point within Krishna consciousness. Sometimes when we're preaching, you know, most people find it easy to give up intoxication, give up gambling, even meat eating's not a big deal. But when it comes to sex life, that's the one they go, I don't know about that one. So in Krishna consciousness, Prabhupada was very adamant. This is the four regulative principles that we follow. So this is not for everyone. And thereby Krishna consciousness is not going to be a movement that is going to encompass everyone. But Krishna consciousness selects very, very exceptional personalities. And these personalities have the same opportunity that Markandeya Rishi had to see the Supreme Lord by being steady. Now the greatest happiness a jiva can get, a spiritual soul can get, is freedom. Complete freedom, as I mentioned. Freedom from misery. Freedom from unhappiness. Freedom from suffering. Freedom from the dictates of desires. And freedom from this trapped encagement of this material body. When we came to Krishna consciousness, these were some of the first things that happened. You know, we came with anxieties, we came with a lot of confusion, we weren't sure of our own personality, we didn't know about the universe, And as soon as we became devotees, even within the first few months, so many stresses, so many anxieties, so many fears were alleviated. I had one in particular. I was working at an old people's home. I mentioned this once before when I became a devotee. And when I used to walk around this old people's home, a retirement village, I was saying to myself, "Oh God, if there is a God, please don't let me end up in one of these places. Because if you ever want to see real misery manifests at the end of one's life in one of these retirement villages. Your body is incapacitated. Your family has left you. There are people that are looking after you that don't really care for you. They'll just feed you, wipe your bottom, take you to the toilet, wash you, and you feel completely incapacitated. And this is misery. People were crying and in pain. So I was saying to myself, I don't want to end up like this. This is not how I envisaged that life should be. And so I became a devotee. And I joined this amazing, huge family, a worldwide family, that would never allow a person to pass away in such a condition. We would always be there to support one another. And we've seen that time after time for the years that Bhakti and I have been in devotional service. We've seen so often devotees that have passed away, that their life has come to an end, were so well supported by the other devotees and their family, their spiritual family, in that they had, even devotees that had left for a period of time and at the end of their life chose to come back to Krishna consciousness and were looked after so lovingly and so caringly by the devotees that when they passed away they were in complete peace, completely relaxed, and just went to Krishna. So this is one of the first fears that was eliminated from my consciousness when I became a devotee, and that's the same with so many of us. And then the last one, what keeps us ensnared, is sensual and mental pleasures. And the hardest freedom to attain is the freedom from sex desire. This is the one that we have to work with. We're all the same. You're not exclusive. We're all going through this thing. And we have to somehow or other battle this energy, this incredible, enticing power that holds so many in the material world at bay, keeps them controlled. It's amazing, in the age that we live in at the moment, how they exploit this sex desire. Everything, from selling things, from movies, books. A film won't get sponsorship. Did you know that a film, a movie, will not get sponsorship from a major corporation unless there is a sex scene in the movie? Because they fear that if there's not a sex scene in the movie, it won't be a success. So they won't get sponsorship. So it's the hardest thing to attain, freedom from sexual desire. The process of spiritual life, yoga, is the means by which we can attain this perfection. And to free ourselves from a night and day dream. This was when we were in Sydney, I was giving a class on a night and day dream. That actually we have our night dream, and actually this material world is nothing more than a day dream. And so most people are interested in just basic animalistic tendencies while they roam around in this daydream. They like to eat, they like to sleep, they like to move. So this is their tendency. And the more you are on the bodily concept of life, the more you are attached to these material things, the more you actually engross yourself in this daydream, the more spiritual life is but a fleeting thing. You have no attraction for it whatsoever. On the other hand, if a person actually becomes more spiritually conscious, then what happens is you can live without such concerns, become very free, you start to become liberated. So basically, one has to somehow or another increase in spiritual dedication, increase in the sadhana, increase in following very steadily the teachings of one's guru and Srila Prabhupada, and that way the enticements of Cupid become less and less. Some live only for sex life in the material world, And what happens is there's continuous unrest and dissatisfaction. You can see in today's society more and more, there's more divorce than there's ever been. It's now said that I think one in three, is it, Bhakti, that we read recently, or two in three even, something like that. It's some huge amount. 54%, is it? Yeah. Marriages now end in divorce. And the other thing which is an amazing statistic is the amount of affairs that people have. Extramarital affairs is also increasing. So this basic unrestricted sex desire is just basically gross selfishness. You know? And selfishness is a sinful act, and it leads to sin. Sinful acts keep one on this bodily platform. Lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. And it will keep one suffering. As long as we maintain the illusion that this material existence is a reality, and that I should try and enjoy in this reality, this daydream, then ultimately you're just headed for suffering, lifetime after lifetime. The desire again to have illicit sexual activities keep one bound in the bodily condition and keep one constantly identifying oneself with the body. We keep one identifying male, female, and not the broader understanding. And temporary pleasure dilutes one's energy. These sexual proclivities that we have dilutes one's energy. There's an energy, there's a losing of either of spiritual energy, because it's one and the same thing. If you study the Ayurveda, the sexual energy, the power that drives one to procreate, is the same energy that drives our spiritual awakening. So if you use it, you lose it. It's as simple as that. The spiritual energy that we need to actually become self-realized is the very same energy that you lose in your in illicit sexual activities. So the trick for a devotee is to remain celibate. Even in ashram, in the brahmachari ashram, grihastha ashram, to remain celibate. And maya keeps one preoccupied with so many things. The arrows of Cupid are being shot all over the place. It's very hard for a person to actually maintain celibacy without some spiritual strength behind them. If you see any advertisement, you'll see there's enticement there. If you go to a movie, you'll see enticement there. If you go on the internet, you'll see enticement there. Everywhere it is there for us. And maya preoccupies the person with this spiritual, with this sensual allurement of enjoyment of material sex life. Whereas in actuality, it is such a fleeting thing. If you really honestly analyze it, all the trouble that you go through for a little sex enjoyment is a fleeting, infinitesimal, gone in a will of a wisp. It's not worth it. And then at the end of it, you're left depleted and completely unsatisfied and suffering. So, like say for example, a normal materialist, he's striving so hard, Prabhupada calls them as-muda, striving so hard to make a living, just to get a little bit of sex life at the end of their day. And then they go out and work again, and they have to raise their family, they have to pay their bills, and then a little bit of sex life again. And all this energy is wasted, and they don't have any chance or any opportunity for spiritual emancipation, spiritual release. But then again, on the other thing, Prabhupada also called it chewing the chewed, just continuously, well, this is the only pleasure I can get, so we just have to. And one of the, again, harping back to that time when I was at the old people's home, the retirement village, this was the one thing, even at old age, that people couldn't give up. They were still very much wanting to enjoy sex life. There was an old guy there who must have been about 85 years old, and he was pretty well infirmed. He just couldn't, you know, function. And still, he was chasing after old ladies in the retirement village. So much so that the head matron, the nurse, had to give him an injection to calm him down, and then they just laid him out on a bed like a vegetable. So this is the material world, is very gross. But then again, when we analyse this whole sexual issue, sex life on religious principles, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, I am that act. I am that act. So there's nothing wrong with the actual... Some people think that the actual act of sex is a dirty thing, it's a disgusting thing, but Krishna says, I am that act. And that act is for the procreation of children. And in procreation of children, we develop a spiritual relationship. And the goal is the one thing, to create another living entity that will be a servant of God. And when one has a spiritual relationship like that with one's partner in life, and has this relationship of celibacy within marriage, it becomes a relationship where there is no anxieties. So there are a lot of young men and women that are becoming married, young men and women. Some have just got married, some are about to get married. But in Krishna consciousness, in marriage, it's a threesome. It's never ever a twosome, it's a threesome. The third party is always Krishna. Krishna is always there. Within any part of our marriage, Krishna is always there in a Krishna conscious marriage. He's the center. And when we know from all the Shastras, when we put Krishna in the center, there's no problems, no anxieties, no suffering. Although it's a material world, sufferings may come a little bit. But the thing is, with a supportive spiritual partnership, problems can be overcome. There's nothing that cannot be overcome. So one has to do some things. One has to make one's home an ashram. It's no different to a temple ashram. If one makes one's home an ashram where the raising of children are done in a Krishna conscious way, where everything is geared towards and centered towards God, it's a very wonderful thing. And this ashram is one of selflessness and equality. It's not that we see that our partner is lesser or greater than us. It's on an equal level. We all have our duties to perform. And so on this ashram, it's actually called Vaikuntha marriage. Vaikuntha marriage. Anxiety-free marriage. So in this ashram, we see each other equally. And we work for each other's benefit. And what happens is we protect one another from the onslaughts of Maya. In a Krishna conscious marriage, we protect one another from the onslaughts of Maya, because she's out there. And so the husband can direct one's love and affection to his wife, and the wife can direct one's love and affection to the husband. In a very natural way, in a friendship way, in a loving way. And these relationships are also there in the Vaikuntha planets. Loving relationships. But the sex life is not there. The desire to enjoy for oneself is not there. It is only to serve Krishna. This is the wonderful thing in the spiritual world. Sex life in the spiritual world is not very significant. And people in the Vaikuntha planets and in the spiritual world are far more beautiful. And there's far more area to enjoy. So we have to be serious in our devotional service. We have to stay fixed, just like Mukundaya Rishi here was fixed. And no matter what Cupid was throwing at him, he was able to stay fixed. And so this is required. And then what happens, as we saw with Mukundaya Rishi, the Lord protects his devotees. So in this day and age, in Kali Yuga, by the mercy of the great Acharyas and especially Srila Prabhupada, this process of being fixed has been made very, very easy. We don't have to be like Mukundaya Rishi, who have to seriously meditate. We simply have to do service. We simply have to somehow or other be attracted to Krishna. And Krishna's love surpasses anything And Krishna himself surpasses anything that's here in this material world. And this love and reciprocation that Krishna offers is there for all. But it's only a few that will accept it. So we have to somehow or other be really diligent and hold on to our spiritual life and love and develop our love for Krishna to stay fixed in devotional service. We have to be very connected in our sadhana. We have to identify ourselves with Krishna, and that will bring about perfection. We have to see that Krishna is the most important thing in our life, and we, our selfish ego, has to be deflated and become a humble servant of the Supreme Lord. This humility is what we strive for, just to be humble. So if you have a balloon, you know how you deflate the balloon. When we're a materialist in gross consciousness, we're very puffed up. But if we are a spiritualist and a devotee, we deflate that balloon. We want to be humble. So humility is the thing. We have to take advice from great souls, just as we're getting the advice here of Suta Goswami, as Sanaka Goswami is asking. We're having to really be diligent in our service, be humble and take advice from saintly people. This is really important. Wherever we can, we have to take advice from saintly people. People that, like Markandeya Rishi, are able to control their senses, are not allured by the material attraction, are able to stay fixed in service to Krishna and maintain their loving relationships. So this is very important, and recently we had a great opportunity to go to Sydney and associate with devotees that we hadn't associated with for many years. It was the 40th anniversary of the installation of Radha Gopinath. Prabhupada brought Radha Gopinath to Sydney, and so it was a wonderful time where we could meet with devotees who were the very first people that preached to us when we came to Krishna consciousness, and who encouraged us to live a free life, to become free from this illusory daydream. And so we had an opportunity to actually thank them for what they did for us. And so this association is very, very important. And it was also pointed out throughout that whole week that the greatest process of this age to protect ourselves from the onslaught of Maya and the onslaught of Cupid is A, chanting the holy name with real dedication, with real connection, with real attention, with real service attitude, and B, to constantly try somehow or another to present this to other people that are still suffering and are still fearing and are still living in illusion. Because there are people, although people in Krishna consciousness are a rare personality, we're only a small fraction of the total society. Still, there are people out there like you who have had enough of this material world and are willing to listen to you. So we have to make an effort to actually be there for a person. As Krishna says in the last chapter of Bhagavad Gita, that person that presents Bhagavad Gita, that presents his philosophy, that actually helps a person to this ultimate freedom, that helps a person to overcome this incredible disease of sexual desire, to help a person attain a more wonderful existence, a loving existence with the Supreme Lord, that person to Krishna is the most dear. Krishna makes a point of that if you just preach to me, that person is the most dear, and they will very quickly come to me. So just like Markandeya Rishi, that Krishna will manifest himself to those personalities even in this lifetime. So there are many opportunities for us. While I was in Sydney, I had an opportunity to read an interesting book that was given to me by one of our interfaith people, and it was really an eye-opener for anybody that's preaching. It was given to me by Shankarananda Swami from the Shiva Ashram, and he said, "Bhakti, I think you'll like to read this." And it was called American Veda. Has anybody here heard of this booklet? Book? Anybody? Nobody. If you get an opportunity, it might be worthwhile, not necessarily purchasing, but if somebody has it, it's interesting. it depicted or it showed how from this how Vedic culture is starting to influence Western culture or American culture. So as America goes, so goes the whole world, so to speak. So what this gentleman had done was he had chronologically pointed out all the different sages and saints that came to America and changed their whole concept of life and their whole concept of spirituality, starting from Emerson, who was influenced by some writings of the early early 18th century, but then more importantly when Vivekananda first came, and then Yogananda and all the other gurus and so on and so forth. And it all led up to Srila Prabhupada. It all leads up to Srila Prabhupada. He didn't mention that. He himself was a TMer. But if you read it, you can see that all this was like fertile ground. For, you know, like Krishna says, the impersonalist aspect of God is one aspect, but there's a higher point. And so if you can't do that, well, the impersonal aspect is okay, but devotional service is the highest. So you could see that it was all leading for Prabhupada to come. And it was pointed out that the Hare Krishna movement was the major force that gave kirtan, that clearly explained reincarnation for the first time, and of course prasadam, vegetarianism. And it was also noted that out of all the gurus that came in the 70s, because the 70s was like a highlight, they said actually the most influential time and the most influential moment was when the Beatles went to Rishikesh to study under Maharishi. From there, everything changed. And then George Harrison became a devotee, My Sweet Lord was a number one hit, and so on and so forth. From there, things started to change very rapidly because the people of that time, the hippie culture, were just very, very enlivened to learn something more about devotional life and about spiritual life and the Vedas, because they were completely dissatisfied with this material existence. And so the one thing that they said about Srila Prabhupada personally was that out of all the gurus that came during the 70s, he was the only one where there was no sexual innuendo behind his private life. He was like Markandeya Rishi. Dhira. Not shifting. Not moving. Whereas all the other ones, there were scandals. Did they? Didn't they? Even Yogananda, who I thought was quite a saintly sort of personality, apparently there was some mischief that he got up to with some of his nuns. And then there was Maharishi, and there was Muktananda, and there were all these sexual implications. So you can see that even these great Brahmanandis that came from India to teach the Veda and Vedanta and Advaita, one by one they fell down. And even to this day, there are now gurus in India that are falling down. So many. There's one recently, actually. And I won't mention who it is, but a lot of his disciples come here, and there's a whole innuendo behind his life as well. And so this sex life is a big thing, you know, so we have to be on guard. But the thing that it was pointing out, this book, just to finish up, the thing that this book was pointing out was that the opportunity for preaching, the opportunity for us to actually become really instrumental in developing bhakti yoga and developing love for God has never been more appropriate. Because at the moment, it is ripe. They actually compare this time in human history as like a new renaissance. A new renaissance. You know, when the renaissance happened in the early 14th, 15th century, it was like, wow, there's so much new, a new life, renaissance. So what's happening in Western culture, people are becoming really enthralled by Vedic culture. You know, like things like the kirtan, you know. No one has been so interested. I mean, they're actually now going to have a special category in the Grammy Awards for bhajan and kirtan. So this is an amazing thing that's coming about. And who are the leaders in kirtan? The devotees. who actually brought kirtan to the West, Prabhupada, in the Thompson Square Park, standing under a little tree. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. This is amazing. And now people are taking to it, that it's really the thing to do. They don't want to go to the nightclubs anymore. They want to go to a bhajan, a kirtan, you know? And they actually describe that it's more fun because you're not intoxicated. There's no sexual conquest to be made or anything. We just sit there with our eyes closed and meditate on these wonderful mantras of Krishna and all the divine personalities and become absorbed and filled with a happiness and a satisfaction that is not comparable to anything else that's going. Like Bhakti and I were just recently in Sydney and we visited the Lotus Room that Pratapana Prabhu and Jai Shri have set up above Govinda's. Below Govinda's. Has anybody been there? Absolutely amazing. There was about 100 people, young men and women, just completely absorbed in kirtan. And they were young, vibrant young men and women, just completely absorbed. And when you see my dear godbrother, Sri Prahlad, you know, leading kirtan, hour after hour after hour, and people are just so swept up with it. So kirtan is huge at the moment. So we should take advantage of that and become really out there presenting kirtan. We also have vegetarianism, the vegetarian catering. We got feedback from the catering that we did here for the Buddhist Society. In my interfaith, I get feedback from what they thought about the catering. They were over the moon. They couldn't believe, Adrian, what prasadam was coming out to them. They were just so overwhelmed by it that every meal was so ecstatic that they were just absolutely, completely blown away. Now, okay, they're Buddhists. They're striving for some sort of perfection. And you've been giving them prasadam every day, three meals a day. Yum, 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 yum. With great appreciation, serving Krishna. Yum, 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 yum. Next lifetime, they're going to be devotees. They have to. Krishna manifests himself like that. Krishna is really important, you know, and we should promote that more and more. Get our friends, cook for your friends, and offer prasadam to them. And then the other thing is interfaith. As my dear friend Raja Krishna here is here also, interfaith is such a growing movement. Within the 21st century, people are looking for a unified religious system. Not that it's one religion, but a system that actually is compassionate and is respectful and is tolerant, not tolerant even, is more in a mood of learning from one another about one's spiritual life. And just accommodating and helping one another to raise their consciousness in spiritual life. So this is happening. We see that at our interfaith functions, that people are wanting to, and Krishna consciousness is just such a wonderful thing. It's so encompassing and helps. The other thing is Hinduism. It's amazing that the Hindu community is also wanting to find real knowledge. Real knowledge. We went to one program in Sydney where the influence of the devotees hasn't been so prominent. And they had a sumptuous feast for the broader community. They had people from the Muslim faith. They had ministers and so on and so forth. And it was supposed to be a Hindu program. Now, Hinduism is supposed to be, it's a misnomer, but it's supposed to be the religion of India, the religion of the Vedas. They had no worship at the start, no mention of God, nothing, right? And then they had some guy singing songs from movie themes, and then they had Bollywood dancers that were gyrating with skimpy little clothes on and everything. And myself and Abhay, who's the chairman of the Hindu Community Council here in Victoria, were looking at each other and saying, what the hell is this? How can they do this? And there was one Muslim gentleman there. It was very embarrassing, actually. One Muslim gentleman was there. He's a prominent Muslim leader. Every time there's something to do with the Muslim faith, he's the one that's on television. He was so embarrassed by the dancing that he had to turn his head away like this. and for the whole performance while these kids in their skimpy littles and them dancing around. He was embarrassed. It was embarrassing. So we made a comment to these people that this is not Sanatana Dharma. This is not Vedic culture. This is shocking. And he was very apologetic. And so they need the devotees to be part of it. Not that we're going to win people over, but we are the standard. When we go to these different Hindu functions or interfaith functions, we set a standard. People know our principles. People know that we want to serve and love God. People know that we follow the regulative principles. And people know that we are true, that we stick with the path. We're dearer. We're not whimsical. So this is really important. And the other area, of course, is coming from that is chaplaincy. We're now coming to an area where we're able to do chaplaincy work, paid for by the government, where we can go to hospitals, where we can go to retirement villages, where we can go to prison systems, where we can go to different things, and teach people about Krishna, and teach people about the freedom that's there to be had for everyone. And even if you can't do it to the full, just try a little bit, and eventually it will happen. And even if you're not so diligent and you're not so fixed, and there may be times that you have some weakness, that's okay. Just pick up from where you left off and continue on. Krishna will manifest himself, slowly but surely, and you will get a higher taste. So we owe it. We have to strive to be like Markandeya Rishi. Very, very diligent. Very, very fixed. And same as we have to be and strive to be like our spiritual master, and in particular we have to strive to be like Srila Prabhupada. Very fixed at the lotus feet of Krishna, and very determined to achieve salvation and to achieve freedom from this material nightmare. So are there any comments or questions at all, Prabhu? Yes, Prabhu.
I have got one comment only, and that is, Kirtan is intoxicating.
What?
Kirtan is intoxicating.
Oh, absolutely. Kirtan is intoxicating. It's allowed. Yes, Prabhu.
I use Facebook as a preaching tool, so I posted something that I really felt in my heart this is happening. I said that there is an inner revolution on the planet at the moment, and many people are becoming vegetarian, giving up promiscuity, drugs, etc. and they're raising their consciousness, and they are with higher and higher levels of consciousness even than that.
Yeah.
So I put it there, and then a friend of mine from teenage years, she's in England, she wrote to me, and she said, you won't believe it, but it's been like 1 month, when they put meat in front of me, something makes me like disgusted, I can't touch it.
Mm.
And she said, I haven't taken alcohol for some time, and it's just like inner feeling, she doesn't know why.
Yeah.
So this is going on, there's a lot of people that are actually getting influenced by sattva, by the... They're hearing the Harinam on the street, seeing devotees, something is affecting them like that. So this is actually going on. And the second comment, I was in Croatia now, and the devotees have created something very interesting there. It's called Yoga is Music.
Mm.
It's a brand, and it goes around the whole country. So they invite all the different kirtan groups from this group, that group. I don't know what groups are here in Australia.
Mm.
Yoga groups or different ashrams to do kirtan. So they go and the devotees organize the whole thing. So they bring all their friends, they advertise it big time.
Yeah.
And they have like 5 or 6 hours kirtan, so they have their group singing, different 3 or 4 groups, and then at the end of whatever the devotees sing, they found that this is really unifying.
Absolutely.
Because people feel, wow, this is so nice. They're given an opportunity to express themselves, also to chant. And usually he said they sing Krishna bhajans, or Hanuman or something like that, Ram bhajans. It's all about that.
Yeah.
And then the devotee who organizes it says, when the devotees come to chant, everyone can see the purity.
Yeah.
And in that way, that inspires everyone to raise their standards.
Yep.
So maybe we can think about something here.
It's absolutely true.
Music.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And we're working on that also. And in Sydney in particular, they, when we were there, Manoj, did you go? Did you go to the, what's it called, Bhakti? The Mangrove Mountain? Sachinananda Ashram? They had a program there which was a 2-day program, right? And for 12 hours they were chanting, right? And Prahlad went there, Gitanjali went there and everything. But on this occasion, they said, we're so intoxicated by the holy name, the Maha Mantra, that all we will chant is Hare Krishna. So for 24 hours, just chanting Hare Krishna. And I was speaking to Gitanjali the other day, and she said, it was absolutely, Bhakti, you should have been there. It was absolutely, totally intoxicating. And people were just completely in ecstasy. This is Sachinanda Ashram. And there are some, and they are such close friends of ours now. They come and they chant at our temple. We go and chant at their ashram. And this is the way of the future. And the point that you made, that the devotees add that extra notch, put it in the top gear. When Prahlad, you know, goes, up they go. It was amazing. They were even, a couple of the Sachinanda yogis were on the cruise that we had for all the Prabhupada disciples. They came along and they were in ecstasy, just chanting. You know, so it's intoxicating. Same here at the Shiva Ashram. People love us to come and chant. You know, I was speaking to Swamiji the other day. When are you guys coming to chant again? You know, so it's good. And they're all becoming, you know, it's not that they're going to necessarily, we don't want them to, you know, become devotees straight away. That's not their nature. It's not important. It's just giving in little increments. Just, you know, just in, huh? Heading in the right direction. Yeah. Any other comments or questions at all? Thanks, Prabhu. What's that, Prabhu?
Bhanu Swami gave a very nice gesture only a few months back. He said three things are very important. Jeev Daya, Naam Ruchi, and Vaishnava Seva.
Yeah.
Three books important aspects.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mataji, who had a friend? Yeah.
Once, long time ago, in Europe, they have like this Eurovision competition where all the countries they choose the best
song,
the best singer, and they send it from every country, and then they choose who is the best. And many years ago, I had a dream that there was a Eurovision, and all countries were gathered together, and they were singing, but they were singing to the deity.
Ah, all right, it'll happen. Hurry, roll. If you see that, that's a desire that you have, it'll manifest. Any desire that a devotee has in the development of Krishna consciousness will come to pass. It has to come to pass. It has to come to pass. So this is what we're... But the main thing that I was trying to emphasize here with what Markandeya Rishi was going through was to be able to control that sexual urge. It is a really important thing. And it's not such a big deal. It's not such a big deal. For the materialist, it's a huge deal. But for a devotee, it's not such a big deal. It's not that we won't be afflicted by it. We will be mindful of that. But when it comes, when Cupid comes and he's got his arrows out and the whole thing and the dancing girls and the whole thing, if you, Tamal Krishna Maharaj used to say, and I'll never forget that, and I'm ever thankful for him to say that, when it comes, when that sexual urge comes, stop it at that point. Either chant the Sringadev prayers or do something devotional to stop it. If you stop it at its start and don't take it any further, then you'll be okay. But if you land a little bit, yeah, that's not a bad arrow there, you know. It's a pretty good looking arrow. You're gone. So the trick is, and it's just a trick, it's just a technique. And it's not something that we need to be embarrassed about or think that we're the only one with, you know, that desire. When it comes up, we simply say, Namaste Narasimhaya, protect me, Lord Narasimhadev, where are you? You know, or go to the temple or do something, you know, have a cold shower and Namaste Narasimhaya. and you'll be okay. We have to do it. And then what happens is it becomes less and less and less and less, and then you become Vaikuntha conscious, where it doesn't matter anymore. It really doesn't matter anymore. It's not a big deal anymore. So this is what I was trying. And Markandeya Rishi had everything thrown at him, and he just meditated. Go on, do your stuff, that's it, forget it. And then what happened was he got the sublime darshan of Naranarayan Rishi. That's what we're after. The divine darshan of Radha Ballabha, Gaurinitai, and Jagannathji, Baladev, and Subhadra. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Jai.